Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Guys, welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen. Thank you very much for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking about a spoilers for All of Us Strangers. Yes. If you haven't seen the film, this is a spoiler warning. Please don't listen to this if you haven't yet. I just reviewed it on the main episode and George also reviewed it a few weeks ago.
Yes.
Both gave it a huge thumbs up. We really enjoyed the film.
Absolutely.
It was brilliant.
And we're also going to be doing a review of Naiad, which came out a few months ago, but is being Oscar nominated for Annette Bening's performance in it. And I've been and seen it, so I'll do a little review of that for you. Also, we know Masters of the Air is out at the moment. Neither of us has had a chance to really see it. I tried, but I was sick. But what I have done is I've rewatched Band of Brothers, and I'd like to just give you a little bit about that as well. So we're going to do All of Us Strangers, Naiad, and a little bit of Band of Brothers.
Coming a real sort of like World War II dad.
I'll get onto that, actually. Yeah. That's quite important. But let's first talk about All of Us Strangers.
So just briefly, if you're just joining us now, we did review it in the main episode, but All of Us Strangers is the new film directed by Andrew Haig, starring Andrew Scott, Paul Mescal, Jamie Bell, Claire Foy. It's all about a character called Adam, who is an isolated gay screenwriter who gazes lustfully out into London, and he's very alone and he's trying to write, find inspiration, and two things happen to him, one of which is developing a new relationship with his neighbor Paul Mescal, played by Paul Mescal, and simultaneously he goes back to his family home in Croydon where he grew up, and he goes to visit his parents who died when he was 12 years old, but he is seeing them as they were right before they died at the same age. And he is basically getting to speak to them, talk to them, understand them. It's all about an identity of who you are, understanding his gay identity, trying to reconcile unsaid things between him and his parents, at the same time trying to understand a new relationship with Paul Mescal. It's deeply sad. It's deeply heartbreaking, very cathartic, very intense. It's beautiful. And we just want to talk briefly about some of the plot details. One of the main things in play is that in the very first time Adam and Harry meet, Harry is very, very drunk and he's holding this particular bottle of whiskey.
Yeah.
And he goes to see him, almost like he's got a sort of bit of liquid courage to go and approach this guy and sort of ask him if he wants to essentially come in and hang out. And originally Andrew Scott rejects him and he's just not quite in the right headspace for it and turns him down, and Paul Mescal kind of just sort of goes away. But it comes back to him and they eventually develop this sort of cute sexual relationship. Whilst that's happening, you never get the sense that what's happening with the parents is real, but definitely not real, happening in his head. And one time he actually tries to bring Harry to go and see the parents, and Harry sort of almost sees the parents, but not quite, and gives you a sort of hint that there's a sort of sixth sense thing going on, where like they sort of exist in this purgatory beyond life. But later, what's revealed to us is that he comes home to go and find Paul Mescal for the first time.
Having had this reconciliation with his parents, actually this beautiful sort of freeing moment of go and be happy.
He goes to this cafe and he realizes that their time has basically come to an end. The parents now have to move on. They understand how they've died. They've asked him, you know, did it hurt? Was it quick? And they've essentially sort of moved on. And
Devastating scene.
And he goes back to try and find this new relationship. But what he realizes is that Harry has killed himself with drugs and with alcohol, and he's lying dead on the bed. But what he realizes is that, or what the audience realizes is that, Harry is wearing the same cardigan that he wore the first night he came to see him, and he's drinking the same bottle of alcohol the first night he came to see him. And it's revealed to the audience that actually this relationship existed entirely in his own head, in an in-between reality state, and that nothing you ever actually saw really happened, and that night never really moved on.
So, first of all, I would say, I wouldn't technically say he killed himself, because that implies intent. I think it was accidental. I would say it was just an accidental,
A destructive, unhealthy behavior leading towards a death. Yeah, that's true.
So the thing is about that, what was interesting about the ending, and what I found hard is that I obviously saw that film and I had no one to talk to about it. And the ending, I think a lot of people have some questions about. Just to clarify, because I, when it sort of first revealed itself, I was like, how do I feel about this? Now I've given more time and I feel much more comfortable with it. But I think the film is deliberately elusive about, and to its strength, about where the kind of existence of the parents and Harry kind of sits.
Yeah.
When I read it the first time, the film kind of said to me that as he is a writer, there is an element of the imagination. This is kind of like imagined therapy for him. But I'm realizing now that I actually do think it's much more about, they are spirits, ghosts, and it's much more of a paranormal thing. Because if he was artificial, if he was imagined, as soon as Adam realizes that Harry is dead and it's not been real, then he wouldn't have been able to communicate with him afterwards. And I think because of that last shot, that scene of them on the bed together, that means much more when you realize that. Yeah, that means much more when you realize that Harry is a lost spirit wandering around, a bit like his parents were.
Yeah.
So I was able to reconcile that better. I also think that it works more. It's this brilliant idea that Adam, who's now open to loving other people, but like sees that other people are still victims of loneliness, and like he will care for him. And there's this really interesting motif of quoting, not just using The Power of Love by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, but quoting the specific line, which is, I'll protect you from the hooded claw, keep the vampires from your door. And Harry says it to Adam when he first sees him. And then Adam says it to Harry on the bed at the end. And then the song plays out. And I really like that idea of Adam being open, being like, it's like, I understand. It's too late for you. I've lost you, but I will protect you and I'll look after you. And it's quite powerful.
I really wanted a happier ending. Yes. Like, not as a critique. I was just so sad. And I loved the ending point he got to with his parents. Yeah. Even though none of the interactions were perfect, they were enough.
Yeah.
And for him to sort of better understand who they were, even if he made it up in his own head, which you'd have to do if your parents died, you would have to imagine what conversations they had. And to have them move on and then he goes and finds Harry dead. And that second gut punch when he comes back into the living room and sees what's now sort of a projection of Harry.
Yeah. So you're saying a projection. I think it's a spirit. I think it's spirit,
whatever we're calling it. Yeah, like that version and him also being upset. And I'm like, he's been alone this whole film.
Yeah.
And now he's going to end it still alone.
Yeah. Ready to be, I suppose. I don't know if you... it is... thematically, but if you look at the way I guess he is with Paul Mescal, sorry, with Harry, let's keep calling him Harry, when he first opens the door and he's so shy, and look where he is at the end, and it's like, it's almost like the pain of realizing that he's lost Harry reminds him that he can't be like this anymore because he's going to lose more people that he cares about, and he needs to now go into life like being caring and careful.
I was wondering if the way in which the final shot ends, which is sort of the stars moving towards the beds. They leave
direct,
off the bed.
If I may just say, I think that is a direct reference to a film called Mysterious Skin. Like it's shot for shot, exactly the same. It's a great film and they're kind of thematically similar, but I was like that.
Did you think that the way that was shot almost suggests that Adam is also dead, dying or moving on to a higher plane? Because they sort of float above the body into the stars. He doesn't necessarily like depart Harry, he very much sits with him in that state. I could just be deducing it, but he might not be able to actually live in this world.
Well, you think also Harry's been... so you think Adam's been dead this whole time?
Oh, that's a really good theory, actually, because he's never really anywhere.
Yeah.
And is...
Well, he died long ago somehow, somewhere undisclosed.
Yeah, because the whole... there's never really a good sense of connection to where he is in London or in that tower block. They are just like a series of rooms...
I think, I don't know, you're right, the kind of supernova, supernatural ending with the stars, I read that to be more like a galaxy of stars.
Yeah.
You're full of individual, brilliant brightness, and everyone, but they are, if you look at it the wrong way, isolated, lonely people.
Yeah.
But they are brilliant people, and you will lose brilliant people and beautiful people, If you don't reach out and look after them, these stars will fade away, and you know the night will become blacker. That's where I kind of took from it. It's got
it's so deliberately dewy and romantic.
It's deliberately obscure. in that. And I think
it doesn't need to be more specific to work.
No, no. I think
you're just left with a very strong feeling of this is what we should do with life.
Yeah. I mean, I did read somewhere, I think I said this before, which is like, it is a film. For me, the film is about love, ultimately. That's what the film is about. I mean, it's about lots of things, but like ultimately, when you actually, the common denominator of all of it,
as well.
It's about the power of love. Yeah. And then it is a film in which the power of love plays.
Just in case you didn't know.
And they quote the power of love. So I'm like, I do get it. But the film really is about love.
I just really shipped them as a couple going forward. I'm like, yes, I really
shipped them.
Yeah. You know, you ship a couple, you've heard that.
Nope.
If you ship a couple, you want them to get together.
Well, like you like want to send them on their journey. Oh, I ship them.
Oh, I don't. Yeah, it could be. You've never heard of that. I ship them as a couple. Anyway, I was like really happy. I really thought they had a really beautiful relationship. It was very tender and a bit slow, but they really felt. I really felt like they worked for each other.
Yeah, they did.
And I thought, oh, he'll have this all this stuff with his parents, get through his demons, and then he'll like find this. Paul Mescal clearly has some demons he needs to work out.
Yeah, but I guess that's it. It's like it's not like you solve the trauma in your past and everything's done. It's like you have to you have to work hard in the present to make connections and stay with people. Anyway, I want to read another email we got that we didn't read out on the main show.
In an easier film, he would have like gone on a plane to New York and landed there and got a job at the magazine house.
Would this film have had the power it has had with such a clean ending, a clean, happy ending? I don't know.
Yeah.
Katie writes in about All of Us Strangers.
Yeah, it's true. Sorry. If they had just ended up together holding hands in the park.
It's not as good as a film, is it? That's the thing. I'm happy for my heart to be jerked around. Yeah. Or as Katie says in this email, my heart is no longer. Hi, gents. I'm new into the podcasting world, but after being targeted on Instagram with videos of your games, which are brilliant, by the way, I have stayed. In brackets, the mix of intellectual debating and conversation, also fun-filled games, is a brilliant sweet spot. Thank you.
Thank you.
I decided this week that I wanted to get out and go to the cinema more. Something I used to do a few times as a kid, but honestly, I've only been twice to the cinema since COVID and fell asleep during both.
Okay.
Having a complicated relationship with anxiety and mental health makes it hard to want to go out and watch something, but hearing your enthusiasm in your podcast made me want to.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been on the hype with something before. Still haven't seen Barbie or Normal People, but I had a visceral want, read, need to see All of Us Strangers. And your review was 100% on the nail, an emotionally charged performance by the whole cast. A sad reality is that all the characters of Adam and Harry have stark relatability. I'm going to read that line again. I'm not quite sure how it's phrased, but a sad reality is that all the characters of Adam and Harry have a stark relatability, whether it's through conversations we wish we had, exploring love before it was lost, sexuality, isolation, feeling left out, and dreaming about what it could have been. The common themes and links are great throughout. It took me a little while to gather the vampire by the door link to the power of love, but that acts as a great silver thread. They managed to do what Last Christmas did, but in my opinion, with less cheese and more grace.
Yeah, absolutely. Did
it's Last Christmas, but better. Last Christmas, which is a terrible film, that is so spot on. Yeah,
so funny. I like that Harry always, despite being very, I'm at the door, and I'm sort of this new interest. He did always feel like a real person to
me.
I think that's a really hard balance to strike.
But because Adam is as substantial as a character as Harry in the sense that.
Yeah.
It's not like we're something like Last Christmas, like Emilia Clarke's doing everything, and then obviously this weird presence. But then, like Andrew Scott playing Adam, as a character, is so ghost-like in himself, and so insubstantial because he's so lonely. It creates this nice parity.
Yeah.
Anyway, lest be said, I did not fall asleep once. All the nominations are well deserved, and I'm also sad to see it wasn't on the list of the Oscars, nor Andrew Scott nominated for a BAFTA. I look forward to the next step, Katie. P.S. I would like to clarify: I do watch film. However, the comfort and I enjoy the comfort and ease of. There's a couple of letters missing here. I'm just trying to get through it. I would like to clarify that I do watch films. However, I enjoy the comfort and ease of streaming services. However, I now understand what it is meant when people say films should be watched in the cinema.
Yeah.
There is a nice unspoken connection between you and the rest of the audience when you are all sniffing along to a film while admiring the cast talent, which is basically exactly what you said.
Mumbling and sobbing.
I had exactly the same thing.
She says, found it quite funny, actually. Just a little bit.
I'm hearing
so many people sob, and I'm also really sad. And I am still sad, but I'm almost like, this is quite funny. Everyone's just like sobbing.
Written whilst trying to pull myself together after leaving my emotional dignity in the cinema. So it's nice, not just about the power of love, it's about the power of cinema.
Nice little triple bill with Sixth Sense and The Last Christmas and this.
Yeah. The best of the three.
You get scared, just sort of bored, and desperate, and then deeply sad.
So
Sixth Sense is sad as well, I guess.
It is, yeah. Anyway, so those are our thoughts on...
I think the cinema experience, for a really long time, I just talked about sort of anxieties about the cinema and sort of how we framed it. It has been like miscommunicated throughout pop culture in the years as like a social experience, when it's not that.
No.
It is not a social experience. You obviously can go, and there are like very social films, like Barbie this year was an amazing experience, like going to see Avengers is always going to be an amazing social experience, but that's not what it is.
No.
And when you start going by yourself, if you have gone by yourself, you're realizing like this is not a social thing at all. It's very much like experiencing art in a dark
room.
You're being
alone together. It's paradoxical, but it works. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you go and it's an ego death.
And also, the chances are some of the first times you went to the cinema were to see a young, fun film with your family or friends that was inherently social. But as I think your taste in cinema develops, and as you see in more and more films, it does really, really change. And I think people who are disliking the cinema because of the people element or the social element, I would say like the more and more you go, I think the less and less it is that for you.
And more enjoy going by yourself.
It's great. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's nice.
And very functional. We've talked about it before.
And when I say like ego death, it's like in the same way that like going to the gym can like clear your mind and you just like, it's just you. It's a bit like going to the gym in the sense that you are there with other people, but you're doing your own thing.
Totally. Like, I like running with other people sometimes.
Yes.
But I almost like sometimes need to just go and run myself at my own pace.
And you go to the cinema and you, whatever you're saying, good or bad, you surrender yourself. Your ego is dead. Your identity is void because you're in a black, dark room watching light on a screen. And then you come out and you're yourself again. You've given time away. Yeah. I mean, you're right. It has been missold and miscommunicated.
Yeah.
And lastly, before we wrap all of us strangers, this email from Hannah who says, "Dear James and George, I found your podcast just a few weeks ago and I'm already obsessed. Thanks for your hard work, entertainment, and poignant thoughts. I finally got the chance to see All of Us Strangers last week and absolutely loved it. I can't stop thinking about it. However, I have two thoughts. Although the ending was beautiful and I was crying like a maniac like the rest of the audience, I almost felt that it became too heartbreaking. I completely agree with George's review and I also love sad films, films that deeply touch me. But I also think that a sad film becomes so much better if you end it on a note that is slightly hopeful or at least bittersweet. I also want to hug Adam, Andrew Scott, and would have preferred to see him find strength in himself, get some sort of closure, or meet someone alive to love. Not a happy ending, but at least something. Well, I do actually think that is the ending. I do think that he has found strength in himself. I do think that he's got some sort of closure and he has met someone. That person just hasn't been alive.
So he's not just killed himself.
Anyway, love the film. Just a thought. And please let me know what you guys think of the ending in a spoiler cast. Well, that's what we've just done.
Yeah.
Hannah. And number two, Andrew Scott was phenomenal and so vulnerable in the film. How on earth did he not get nominated for a BAFTA? Please let me know what you think of the BAFTAs and award shows in general. We just mentioned it. Best wishes from Hannah in Amsterdam.
I mean, that's what we said. Like, is it sad because it's more powerful as an ending? But there you go.
Brilliant stuff. So anyway, that was All of Us Strangers. That was our spoiler review. Really great to have such great responses from people. We loved it too. And we continue. I'm sure we'll get more correspondence from people about it. But let's talk about two other things now. Let's talk about Naiad and Band of Brothers. So let's do Naiad, which is a film that came out a couple of months ago on Netflix, but has been doing the rounds awards-wise because Annette Bening and Jodie Foster have both been getting nominations. And Annette Bening has been nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars this year. And I thought, right, time to fill in some blanks.
Yeah,
let's go and watch Naiad. And I really enjoyed Naiad. I think it's a really solid sports biopic, if you will. It's pretty straightforward, but it is elevated by a few things.
Naiad, Greek?
So, very good question, James. And I'm glad you interrupted me because I was about to go into my review without telling anyone what the story was. So, Naiad is Diana Naiad, a real life person. This is all based on a true story. Diana Naiad is a swimmer who made a name for herself when she was in her 20s in the 1980s by swimming extreme lengths and for extreme durations. She swam around Manhattan Island for it took her like 8 hours. She did 24-hour swims. She did extreme lengths. And it culminated when she was 28 in a swim that she wanted to do from Cuba to Florida. She was obsessed with this idea of Cuba. And it would take 48 hours to do. A 48 hours continuous swim over an incredibly difficult, treacherous stretch of water with violent currents and only like a certain period of time of a year that you could do it. And she said in the 80s when she was going to do it, she was like, this is my last swim and this is what I'm going to do. She attempted that swim and it was not successful. She had to pull out. And then she swam no more. And she then had a very successful 30-year career as a sports correspondent for, I think, NBC, right? We then meet, the film cuts forward to 2010 and we meet Diana Nyad on her 60th birthday. And she's very, very good friends with Bonnie, played by Jodie Foster. They're incredibly active, social. And as it's her 60th birthday, Diana Nyad is thinking more and more about her role, her life and accomplishments that she hasn't achieved. And she is kind of haunted by the memory of the fact that she was not able to complete this swim, as well as being haunted by some other traumas in her past as well. Something to do with her swimming coach when she was just a teenager. People's expectations of her, her relationship with her father. And Nyad, absolutely, she's been drilled this myth into her about what her name means. Nyad is this Greek name meaning like water nymph, meaning, and she was from a young age obsessed with the sea. And she has this kind of like, you're absolutely right, you're absolutely Greek. She has this kind of mythological, self-mythologizing relationship with her name and with water. Mm. So she sees it very much like destiny. And she says after her 60th birthday, she starts swimming again and she says, I'm going to do the swim. I'm going to do the swim from Cuba to Florida and I'm not going to do it with a shark cage. Because what they did try before, you swim alongside this kind of netting around you to protect you from sharks and jellyfish. And she was like, I'm not doing that. That's an assisted swim. I'm going to do it without that. And she says to Bonnie, Jodie Foster, I need you to be my coach. I want you to do this. And she gathers together a sort of a ragtag team of people who are doing it for free because not a lot of people wanted to sponsor a 60, 61-year-old woman swimming between Cuba and Florida. And she embarks on a regime of training to try and do the Cuba to Florida swim without shark protection and without shark cage. It's a really good story. I think it's a really easy, solid watch. And even though some of it might be a little bit nuts and bolts, it's elevated by a couple of things. First of all, Jodie Foster is great, but Annette Bening is fantastic. Great performance, deserved nomination. Diana Nyad as a character is really interesting. This is also what I like. She's very multidimensional because she, on the one hand, is incredibly passionate and headstrong and determined, but she's also difficult, stubborn, illogical, has this kind of vain self-mythologizing thing about her where she thinks it's her destiny. And it's perfectly counterbalanced with Jodie Foster as Bonnie, who brings her back down to earth and says, you know, you're not being realistic, and is this great tonic to who Diana Nyad is. But also Diana Nyad as a character, it was great seeing a character whose strengths are also her flaws. It, like, two sides of the same coin, and I really, really enjoyed that. I also just really enjoyed the friendship between the two of them. It's a great movie about friendship and supporting each other, but like specifically women over the age, gay women over the age of 60 and a great friendship between them. Yeah. And I was like, this is really the love and support they have for each other. It's almost like a platonic love story. They mentioned that they dated like 100 years ago, but they're deep, deep friends and they're deeply supportive.
It's not
another.
What defines their
yeah, it's yeah, sense. They're not romantically linked, but their platonic love for each other as friends is really, really impressive. You've got Risa Fans as well in it as a navigator, and you have also this the actual experience of swimming is so interesting because she's like, I'm swimming for 48 hours straight. I'm not allowed to touch the boat. I'm not allowed to touch anyone. I am, you know, being fed from the boat. I'm going to hallucinate. I'm going to be swimming for so long. I'm going to have salt water burns. There's jellyfish in the ocean. And it's really a crazy kind of story. Yeah. I think it's, if you have a bit of time, I think it's definitely worth a watch. And a couple of weeks ago, Bevan wrote in and said that she had been through a breakup and we were recommending films, right?
Yeah.
And I actually think Nyad's a perfect film because it's about someone who is in a rut, who decides to lift themselves out, and a great empowering story about self-determination and when no one believed in her, because she was a 62-year-old woman to do this swim. So that's Naiad. That's on Netflix. Good performances all around. Give it a watch.
You're in a real sort of true story of adversity.
Yes, I watched it the same day as Society of the Snow, and I was like, yep, here we go. Yep, people didn't believe. And then, oh, yep, here we go. Yeah. Yes, that you can. If you've seen Naiad, let us know your thoughts. I'm sorry, James, I took your bait. Do you want to say it? You say it, go on. Yeah, go on.
If you see Naiad, write in, tell her at pulpkitchenpodcast.com.
And finally, we're going to end this episode with Band of Brothers. And let's just do Band of Brothers quickly, which I'm aware is a 23-year-old TV show that a lot of people might not be recalling to the front of their memory particularly. However,
the box set everyone had.
And I do I should have brought it with me, the metal-cased concertina steelbook, absolutely. Yeah. But Masters of the Air is out at the moment, and it's heavily advertised as from the producers of the Band of Brothers. Hans Spielberg collab. Very quickly, if you haven't seen Band of Brothers, well, you should have done.
Yeah.
Because as I will go on to explain, I realized for my fourth time watching it is one of the best TV series of all time.
But I think it's really...
Due a rewatch.
Yeah.
So very quickly, it follows the true accounts of a company of soldiers called Easy Company in World War II as part of the 101st Airborne Division. They were trained throughout 42 and 43 to... parachute into the European theater of conflict in as part of D-Day. So we follow them from training, jumping into D-Day in June 1944, and then their journey from there to the end of the war over the course of a year. And they encounter very famous campaigns, very famous things. And the story of Easy Company is very interesting over the course of 10 episodes. You meet a broad ensemble of characters, each character given different focus throughout the throughout each episode. But the main character is, broadly speaking, Damian Lewis's character of Dick Winters. You know, whether it's whether it's Operation Market Garden, whether it's the Battle of the Bulge, France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, and Austria. It's a really interesting tale, as we all know. I first saw it, I think, when it came out. I've seen it four times. I've even read the book. But I wanted to watch it this time because, I don't know, new year, new energy. My girlfriend Anna had never seen it. And I was like, okay, it's high time you watch it.
Also a very early, super prestige, high budget television show, which very much, we take those for granted now. But that at the time would have been like period detail, very high budget, battle scenes. You didn't really see that on the small screen.
And it's an HBO production. And it's funny, I remember someone asking once that when you hear the HBO thing, what's the theme tune you hear after it? Yeah. And that was my first experience of HBO. So when I hear the of HBO, I immediately hear the Band of Brothers theme tune after. Yeah. And I will just say the Michael Carmen score for Band of Brothers, exceptional. Yeah. The theme tune, the opening feature is iconic. It's fantastic. So anyway, I rewatched it the fourth time, and yes, it's still fantastic. And I knew that from the first episode going in. What I love is it's shot on film. It's still at that era when it was shot in 2000 and released in 2001. Shot on film, so it has that great grainy tactility. It's also color graded to be very brown and green and like it's looking at a period photo from the 40s. It has what great TV series have, which is no filler. Each episode can stand alone on its own and has great merit and is like embarking on a new film. Not one single filler episode that you think, oh, you could have taken that out. It has 10 solid episodes that each constitute.
What about limited series? They're telling one story and it goes.
And I think this is my main takeaway from it. It's like that TV series, limited series, is 23 years old, but it is still loved by a lot of people. It's ranked on IMDb and across the internet as one of the best TV series of all
Timeless.
Time. And it goes to show that if you make something of good quality, it will last. There's never been a Band of Brothers sequel. I know that they did the Pacific and now they do Masters of the Air. But my point is, for a show that only had 10 episodes 23 years ago, there's a reason people still watch it. There's a reason people like me go back and rewatch it. It's because it's very, very good.
You can show it to your kid in 20 years. And totally. It would still hold up.
And in terms of the quality of the production, it really hasn't dated much at all. I might read an email in a second, which there's like an odd bit of CGI here and there, but you have to really squint to find it. Yeah. Excellent, excellent work.
There's a thing that like a lot of the best CGI from the 2000s, the worst looks bad, but the best CGI from the 2000s looks great today.
Yes.
Whereas the best CGI from the 2010s doesn't look great today. because there's a difference in the style. Anyway,
I also think that there's something, even though it holds up well today as well, there's something refreshingly straightforward about it that I think wouldn't get made now. And what I mean is that it never seeks to necessarily justify its existence by unpacking or having to completely deconstruct every element about it. My point is, it doesn't need, it's about an American military unit in the 40s. I think if that story was made now, they'd really unpack everything about, the moral dilemmas and the role of military and the importance of war. And I think what I quite like about it, and from the era it was made, it was like, well, we all just know that, like, this is a really good story, and it was during a war that was, like, incredibly difficult, but, like, we can kind of broadly get behind. I think, do you understand what I mean? Like, I think now it would get this sort of moral grey area, and I like the kind of quite clean-cut focus of it, and that really helps. I think it's just a really great experience, and I just want to read two emails that we got about it that kind of nudged me to watch it for the fourth time. The first was from Lucy, and she said, we mentioned Band of Brothers recently, and she said, I just finished rewatching the series a few days ago. I just wanted to sing its praises on the off chance that anyone hasn't seen it. And I do agree, if you haven't seen it, absolutely check it out. It's only 10 episodes. What are you missing? That was my other thing. I thought, I was interested to watch it with Anna because I wondered if it was going to be too male militaristic, aggressive. It was the first time watching it, and it was not that case at all because it's handled so sensitively.
Yeah,
she was like, within three episodes, she was like, "I'm going to need to rewatch all of these. They're so great." Lucy continues and says, "I know you often get asked about your favorite film scores, but the Band of Brothers score is definitely at the top for me. It is so beautiful. I never skip the opening credits. Yeah, absolutely never skip the opening credits of Band of Brothers because I enjoy it so much. And its final rendition in the last episode during the baseball game." Not spoiler, coupled with the voiceover summarizing what happened, is it makes me bawl every time. I agree, that's such a good scene. Like most people, I hope, I'm very anti-war, and a lot of war films, looking at Hacksaw Ridge, tend to be saccharine pro-war and just a bit awkward.
Yeah.
However, I'm wiping away that final tear after watching Band of Brothers every time, thinking, wow, that's what a real hero looks like. And that's what I meant. It doesn't need to deconstruct about why we need heroes or whatever. It's just recognizing them for what they did. Yeah. With nuance as well, I like it. There's elements about how some people aren't cut out for war, how it changes people, brilliant. For anyone in the UK who wants to watch The Band of Brothers, they're on Now TV or Sky Atlantic. Also, I agree that Band of Brothers is way better than The Pacific, although The Pacific is worth watching. Also, she says, how good does it look considering its age? Excluding one scene with pretty ropey CGI, I'm always surprised by how it looks and feels like it could have been shot a couple of years ago. That's from Lucy. And then Max also writes in and said that over Christmas, he watched Band of Brothers and he said it was so funny that it was mentioned in the same episode previously. Max also writes in about Band of Brothers and says, it is my first viewing of the series and I've been meaning to watch it for years. It is excellent. I would recommend it to anyone. I realize this is not new news, but I remember the reason I didn't stick with it about 10 years ago, and it was because I struggled to separate David Schwimmer from Friends and couldn't get over him. So David Schwimmer plays, he's in it a few times, but predominantly in the first episode as Herbert Sobel, who is their commanding officer, who is this tyrannical, draconian, brutal officer, also slightly inept. And it is slightly strange seeing him in it, but he's great. He is really great in it. As Max says, couldn't get over him essentially being Red Ross in military uniform.
Also because some of Ross's humor style is to be like a little bit up there. Yeah. Oh, really? We're doing that?
And you know what? Let me finish this thought. I'll get to that. It really took me out of the mood and seriousness of the series. Needless to say, I got over it and it was such an incredible and moving watch. Anyway, just some thoughts that I wanted to send through. On the David Schwimmer thing, I sympathize with David Schwimmer because even at that point when that series was made, Friends hadn't even finished yet.
No, it's 04 Friends.
But we all know Friends now much more than even it was when he was in that series.
Yeah.
My point is that as an actor trying to get away from a famous role, normally over time that role diminishes in size and you extricate from yourself. But now Ross is so much bigger.
David Schwimmer's
so
star,
and so sometimes that can reflect poorly on his performance, but actually he's really great in it.
He's also great in The People versus OJ.
He's a good actor. Yeah, he's really theatre trained, and you can see that in Friends in his comedy style. But there is a bit in the first episode where I was like, oh, that's a little bit Ross, when he's telling someone off and it goes like, this is not just any company, this is Easy Company. And it's meant to go, my sandwich.
Yeah. The Snuggie.
Yeah, exactly. Also, in rewatching Band of Brothers, I came to realize, and I've noticed this before, there are so many famous people in Band of Brothers.
The class of Band of
before
Brothers.
Before they were famous. Yeah. And I've got it written down for you here. That's one of the delights in rewatching it.
I definitely have forgotten
that person
all
is in
these,
it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read for you, James. Here are some of the famous faces who are not famous.
And some of them who've only been famous, like properly famous, the last like 6-7 years.
Yeah.
Like newish.
So you turn on Band of Brothers and you get Michael Fassbender.
Huge.
In it a lot.
And wasn't famous really until 2009, 2008.
Missing Glorious Bastards.
Yeah.
Stephen Graham.
Yeah, Mike.
Yeah. Andrew Scott. He has quite a significant part in the second episode. James McAvoy.
Yeah, huge.
Simon Pegg. Tom Hardy.
Huge.
And inexplicably, for one scene, Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, he was acting. So, he did a bit of acting in the early 2000s.
But all of those actors, what I find quite interesting, who are like side characters within the whole Band of Brothers story.
Are all huge megastars.
Huge megastars and bigger, with the exception of Damian Lewis and Ron Livingston, are actually bigger than the predominant supporting characters within Band of Brothers. That's what I find. Fassbender is actually probably in it the most out of all of them. He's just like, he has a few lines, but he's just also in shots. He's just always there and they're always talking to him. They're like, oh, Christensen, can you do this? And he's just there, oh, Fassbender every time. So that's another little delight to go and see.
I'm often reminded when thinking back of the great TV shows from before the era when we started to say, we're in the golden age of television. Look at all the great TV that's coming out. And it does remind me that when we first like had like the Netflix boom and like the House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, and Breaking Bad, we were like, oh, TV's so great now. I think like I think a lot of us expected that we would get more shows that are considered those 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 all-time greatest shows. But I actually think what we still have like once or twice a year, we get really top shows like Succession, you know, House of the Dragon, whatever you want to call it. But I really do think we get almost the same amount of those 10 out of 10 TV shows. What we actually now have are very loads
baggy middle
of 6 or 7 out, I'm just using numbers, like 6 or 7 out of 10 shows that have been hyper-catered to a very specific audience. Yeah. So like there's a very passable, put it on and it will entertain you for a bit, but it's not new or that refreshing.
Like
show for, you know, women of a certain age or this, or young boys who like this. Like, you know what I mean? All the Star Wars and the Marvel stuff. Just lots of very sort of, it'll entertain you. Yeah. Don't cancel your subscription. But the number of real top tier shows, I don't think really has dramatically increased.
I'd say it's almost like, I think probably the number might have, but the percentage, the ratio is probably still the same.
I don't think the HBO probably of all of them does, but I don't think these networks have a formula to create those shows.
No.
Like you've Apple TV, considering all the money and all the shows they made, haven't yet found like the show.
Also, I think the law of averages just means that the more you make, the baggier the middle is.
Yes.
You're just, that's what you're getting. You're lots of middle shows.
Lots of middle.
And occasionally things surprise you and break forward, and you probably get shows that wouldn't have typically been made and all that surprise you.
And sometimes like you buy lots of tickets to the raffle, like Netflix makes Squid Game. I there's no way they knew it would be that big, but it goes on to be that big. Great, make another one more.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's almost like if we just keep making them, maybe one will hit. But
I think
it does remind you that it's a golden age, but it's not.
Well, I think we're past it now. We're in
peak. Oh yeah,
like, you're like blows of peak TV. But yes. But yeah, you're right. It's not.
There's definitely a pre and post from like sort of 2013, 2010. Yeah. But yeah.
Anyway, that was, if you've seen Band of Brothers or go on to see it following me talking about it.
Let us know.
Let us know what you
Hello,
thought about
it. KitchenPodcast.com. Guys, thank you for listening to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen. We hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, we post full episodes every single Wednesday. If you haven't listened to the full episode, go back and listen to that. We reviewed All of Us Strangers and Society of the Snow. But other than that, we will see you next week. Thank you very much for joining us.
Bye.